So again, welcome everybody. And as I think most of us know, but not everybody, we've been working on looking and thinking about the ox herding pictures. And these are a series of pictures that were originally created in China in the Tang Dynasty around, 800 or so in the Common Era, to illustrate Zen practice, a kind of progression of deepening of meditation practice or practice in general. But also, and I think maybe more importantly, to also show how our practice unfolds and sometimes goes back to a place maybe we've already been. Many Zen teachers talk about it as a spiral rather than like a linear progression. We kind of spiral back, maybe a little bit differently, maybe with more maturity, to a certain stage in our practice. And we've covered most of the pictures. We're down to our last three. And I'm not going to kind of give a summary of everything. Instead, I'm going to jump right into both bull and self transcended. So let's just have a quick look at the picture. So this picture contains the famous emblem or mark of Zen, right? The circle. And in the West, the circle has many different meanings. Quite extensive meanings at that, when we look at it in the history. It kind of represents notions of totality, wholeness, original perfection, timelessness, even God. There's a famous quote that goes like this. God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. And that was by a mystic in the Judeo-Christian tradition, Hermes Trismegistus. God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. And then the Greek philosopher Heraclitus wrote, beginning and end are common on the circumference of a circle. Beginning and end are common on the circumference of a circle. In Japanese, this circle is known as an enso. And it represents awakening in Buddhism. And even in early Buddhism, the time of the Buddha, or the time before Buddhism had spread beyond the Indian subcontinent, awakening was compared to a bright moon, usually a full moon or a bright round mirror. So the circle has, roots going all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And it's said that Nagarjuna, who was the great Indian philosopher, who articulated in great depth this idea of emptiness, this doctrine of shunyata, way back in the 2nd century. At any rate, it was said that Nagarjuna would appear as a luminous circle to reveal the true form of our Buddha nature or his emptiness when he taught in public. He had this kind of mystical ability to appear as a circle. And in one of the famous Zen texts, we don't chant this one, but many centers do, the Xinxin Ming, the way of the Buddha is described like this. Round and perfect like vast space. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess. when we read Zen literature, you know, the stories about the old guys, the old masters, the teachers would often draw ensos in the air or in the dirt or, of course, on paper and brush, illustrating something to the student that could not be expressed in words in an effort to kind of point at the experience, at an experience. And I was doing a bit of research on the Enso, and the earliest example that I could find in Chinese history was during the Tang Dynasty, during the 800s. That was the first one. But when we look at Zen literature, or pictures, it's full of circles and Ensos. And I think along with the paintings of Bodhidharma, do you know Bodhidharma? The kind of guy who brought, supposedly, the practice of Zen from India to China. He looks kind of like me. You know, kind of strange-looking old guy. He has an earring, though. I don't have an earring yet. I'm going to have to get a big earring put in. Unshaven. And anyway, lots of paintings of him. And the purpose of Bodhidharma, is, well, along with the Enso, is to express that moment right now of your life. And many Zen teachers say they can tell the character of a person by the kind of Enso that they draw on paper. And some teachers have their students draw ensos every day as practice to kind of develop their insight and their understanding, right, using art. There is no correct way to draw an enso. And when we look at the ensos that were drawn by our ancestors, we see a huge variety. Maybe you've noticed the one that we have in just by the library, right? Great, big, colorful, dynamic Enso by Kaz Tanahashi. Some Ensos are really symmetrical, and some are really lopsided and irregular. Some are thin and delicate. Some are broad at the base and narrow at the top. Some start at the top of the paper. Some start at the bottom. But most begin kind of on the left side of the paper, and they go around like that. And often the Enso is accompanied with a verse or a few words that deepen the meaning of the Enso. Some examples of those are things like, in heaven and on earth, I am the only honored one, which is when Shakyamuni was born, right, and kind of did a jive action and said those words. Sometimes they'll simply write on it mu, Japanese word for nothing, the deep meditation mu, or they'll write honrai muchi motsu, meaning not one original thing. Those are some of the common ones. But one that I really like, by a famous Chinese Zen poet, Han Shan, said, "My heart is like the autumn moon. My heart is like the autumn moon." Isn't that beautiful? I like that one. I have a book of many Ensos by famous artists, Japanese Zen teachers. And I know, I'll leave this out so we can look at it afterwards, but just to give you an idea, you can see, I know it's a little bit small, but big and strong, fat, wonky, kind of wimpy, little guy, right? Begins with a point, kind of strange. Usually they begin with a good, firm beginning, but this one begins with a little bit of kind of a point, right? Pretty symmetrical, etc. And these are all famous ones, historical ones, that are from library, from museums and things like that. So I'll leave this out and you can have a look at that, and then they also translate the inscriptions that are there as well. There's one that's being carved in wood afterwards and preserved. Very beautiful. Sometimes they even write koans on the paper that they've done the enso on. Like one that I've seen is, "This is your parents before you were born." No, how did it go? "This is your parents' face before they were born." Interesting. And sometimes they're playful, almost like telling jokes. One that I saw said, "Is this the moon? A rice cake or the top of a bucket?" Or maybe just the head of a bald monk. So these pictures that we've been looking at, the Oxfording pictures and the Enso, are examples of Zen art as sacred art. But sacred art is not, in the Zen tradition, to deepen our devotion, or to remind us of the teachings and tenets of Buddhism. This art is a direct expression of the ineffable. This art is to make visible what is invisible. That's what it's for. The great scholar and promoter of Zen Buddhism, D.T. Suzuki, who did a lot of his work in the 1950s, wrote this. He said, "The arts of Zen are not intended for utilitarian purposes or for purely aesthetic enjoyment, but they're meant to train the mind, indeed to bring it in contact with ultimate reality." So as you can tell from the book I just showed you, and looking at Kaz's pit and the one on the paper here, each Zen master has his or her own style when they start painting these ensos. So when you look at this one in the paper, what impression do you have? What character? What's the character of this Zen master who painted this? In some versions of the Oxfording pictures, this is the last picture, the last in the end of the sequence. But in this version, it's only number 8. We got some more to go. Here, both the ox and the ox herder are forgotten. The empty circle stands alone. There's no longer any ox. That is, no longer any sense of conceptualizing truth, or dharma, or true self, or a Buddha nature, or whatever. And there's no subject, right? There's no I, me, or mine there either. So there's no subject trying to kind of conceptualize or verbalize, you know, emptiness and truth and Buddha nature. Both subject and object are seen through. So at this point, even thoughts about yourself are no longer an issue, about how good or how bad you are. It's just life unfolding without any manipulation. You know, so much of our practice and attitude when we first take up our Zen practice is that there's something outside of us, some truth or understanding that we're trying to reach out and grab. Something we may describe as, you know, the absolute or God or Buddha nature. And maybe in our practice, or maybe even before our practice, we have some intimation of that. But the teachings of the ox herding pictures encourage us to don't stop there. don't stop the fact that you have a little experience, a little intimation, that there's something bigger than yourself. Sometimes people come for the first time to Mountain Rain. Doesn't happen too often, but sometimes they come, they say, oh, I had this great experience. I was just looking at this telephone pole and suddenly, and they fill in the blank of, what the strange experience they had. And, but it's my, at that point, it's my experience. Right? I had this great experience. And the Oxfordian pitcher says, that's a start, but you need to go a lot further. How do you drop the I? So it's no longer my experience. And then how do you drop the experience? So it's just life. See what I mean? In the picture before this one, the one we looked at last, he's in the hut, right?
Yeah.
Right. So the ox is gone, right? We're kind of no longer trying to verbalize it and put this wonderful experience or whatever it is in words, but the ox herder remains. And so perhaps we see this a deep expression of kind of oneness with the world. But there's still that subtle dualism there. I am one with the world, right? I'm calm. I'm in deep samadhi. That's still there. So no matter how compassionate and peacefully we're living, we're still a little bit caught in this world of dualism with a sense of separation between ourselves and others. When we just stay in that place of I am at one with the world. And the picture of this Enso is indicating that the sense of I in the world, that dualism, that too has to be let go of. That too we need to somehow throw away. So in this picture of both bull and self transcended, all dualism is gone. And it's expressed in just this simple circle. It has nothing to do with our ideas of awakening or not awakening. As Dogen Zenji, the Japanese teacher who brought this form of Zen practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, as he wrote in a very famous passage of his book called Genjo Koan, he said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. And when actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of awakening remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. Does it make sense? No trace of awakening remains. It's no longer, Michael's awakened. I got it. And there's no it. Let's look at the poem here. Can someone read that for us?
Whip.
Oh. Go ahead, yep.
Whip, rope, person, and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. I have abandoned the whip and ropes.
Hmm. So here in the poem, the message of unity is pretty clear. But also note the line, this heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. action without picking and choosing, without a strong sense of I or me. Just your life unfolding. Just your life unfolding naturally. Like a mother or father picking up their crying child without thinking, right? Just, of course your child's crying, you pick it up. It's not like, there's no thought. I'm busy. Or just pick up your child. Or at night, in the middle of the night, the hand reaches back to adjust the pillow. Or hugging the lover you haven't seen for a long time. Right? These are not things that you plan and orchestrate. They just happen, don't they? They just happen. That's what it means. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. We're not planning and orchestrating it, just our life. We respond to the world. We respond with compassion. We respond with what needs to be done. Nothing stains those actions. You don't pick up your crying child because you think, oh, then she'll love me more. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Isn't that a great question? Got an answer? Well, here's one answer. It can't. In this world of ceaseless change, how will you keep yourself separate? How will you really stand off to one side? And have you ever really been able to do that? We think we're separate all the time. Like a snowflake in a raging fire. Well, let's have a look at the next picture. So this is a picture of nature, right? The self and the absolute dissolved when the sense of things of outside of myself, right? When those things are no longer a concern, what emerges, right? What comes forward? Well, there's a willow, a stream, the sound of rain, a man walking a dog, a sick friend in need, the alarm clock ringing in the morning. This is just the realization of the way things are, as they are, in their naturalness. Remember that Dogen passage I read? When we forget the self, the myriad things come forward. Just as they are. All things in life accepted, taken just for what they are without our added story. Tired, sick, hungry. It's just your life. The story of damn it, is the story we add on, and that's our suffering. This picture tells us that our journey, this place we find ourselves, is also not special. Or maybe it's telling us the place we find ourselves is always special. We're always at the source. The source is another word for that deep truth that enters through our eyes and through our ears and awareness and touches the world around us directly, with no separation whatsoever. In Zen, there's an expression, not even a hair's width of separation. That's how intimate we are with this world. Both bull and self transcended, and reaching the source are kind of like two sides of the same coin, I think. When both bull and self are transcended, what is manifested is this returning to the source. Back in the Garden of Eden, maybe, hey? Let's read this little poem next. Somebody like to do that? You want it?
Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on, and the flowers are red. I have abandoned the whip and the ropes.
Too many steps have been taken. Returning to the root and the source, better to have been blind than deaf from the beginning. So this is a little bit of Zen humor, pointing out that we have never really been separate from the source. The long journey is to discover that we are the source. But as T.S. Eliot wrote, and I quoted a couple of weeks ago, we return to the source, we return to where we began and know it for the first time. My old Aikido teacher used to chastise us, students, when I was in Japan, to practice until our moves became second nature. Right? And then he said, then practice further until there are no moves to master. I never understood what he meant at that time. Practice until there are no moves to master. It's just life, not manipulated. So let's look at the last one. In the world. Isn't that a delightful picture? Rather plump, rather unsightly, unshaven man with his clothes askew. And yet he looks happy, even joyful. So different from the images of the Buddha in classical India, who's usually a little bit emaciated, giving a sense of, you know, strong asceticism. World renunciation, maybe of transcendence. The figure here is, I think, depicted, and he often is, carrying an enormous bag on his back, kind of like Santa Claus. And everything he owns is in this bag. He doesn't have a house. And when he's given presents, he gives everything he's received to the children who are always gathered around him and playing and laughing. So this last picture is about returning to the world and experiencing a deep sense of joy and playfulness in one's daily life, no matter what. No matter what. A very dear friend of mine who had practiced for a number of years, Jeannie Robinson, contracted cancer. And she had been a dancer in her younger years. And I remember going to visit her on Salt Spring Island when she was nearing the point where she would have to go into hospice. And we were talking about funeral arrangements. And she said, well, it's just my turn. It's just my turn. In other versions of this auctioning pictures, sometimes this last picture is called returning to the marketplace. The struggles of our daily life continue, right? We still will grow old, sick, and die. Zazen does not guarantee a long life, unfortunately. But yet now, we're able to live right in the midst of whatever happens in our life. A sense of lightness, a sense of inner freedom. Life struggles and challenges are not left behind, and they're not transcended, but in fact, they're plunged into with a sense of acceptance and some equanimity. Why does this end with a return to the world and the marketplace? Well, remember that Shakyamuni Buddha, after his great awakening under the Bodhi tree, could just have gone back to his wife and kid in the palace, right? He could have been driving his Mercedes-Benz around, playing video games, and surrounded by dancing girls. Or he could have just practiced by himself quietly, you know, in the woods, away from the hustle and bustle of the world. But instead, he taught for many years. And when we read about those years, he suffered quite a bit. You know, monks arguing, fighting with one another. His cousin tried to kill him several times. It went on and on, right? He didn't have an easy time of it. But as we practice, compassion naturally arises. When we deeply see the truth of no separation between the I of this body and the person begging on the street, or the hungry cat, or the lonely elder sitting on the park bench, what other response is possible than to come forward with open hands? In our practice, we chant the Bodhisattva vows to save or free all beings, right? That's part of our Bodhisattva chants that we do. And we chant to remind us of what we hold most important, this great compassion and love for the world. But perhaps the picture is telling us at this point, there is no forgetting. The gates of compassion are thrown wide open. And we just dance with the world as needed. Let's read this last verse. Would someone else like to read that for us? Alice?
Barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust laden, and I am ever blissful. I use no magic to extend my life. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. I have abandoned the whip and ropes.
Yeah. This abandoned whip and ropes, by the way, means this kind of like strong effort that we've used to get ourselves on the cushion and that kind of thing. So this last picture leaves us with our own question. How will you be in the marketplace of your life? How will you bring alive dead trees? I'd like to end with a poem. that I think really shows us what it's like to live in the marketplace. A poem by Dokkan, one of David's favorites. So Dokkan was a Japanese poet from this particular Zen tradition, and he was he lived about in the 1700s, early 1800s in Japan, of course. So this is a poem he wrote. First days of spring, the sky is bright blue, the sun huge and warm. Everything is turning green. I carry my monk's bowl and walk to the village to beg for my daily meal. The children spot me at the temple gate and happily crowd around. Dragging at my arms till I stop, I put my bowl on a white rock, hang my bag on a branch. First we braid grasses and play tug-of-war. Then we take turns singing and keeping a kickball in the air. I kick the ball and they sing, they kick and I sing. Time forgotten, hours fly. People passing by point at me and laugh. Why are you acting like such a fool? I nod my head and don't answer. I could say something, but why? Do you want to know what's in my heart? From the beginning of time, just this, only this. Well, we've reached the end of the oxygen pitchers. I hope you enjoyed them, and feel free to take the paper home. And now, I have managed to talk fast enough to leave us a few minutes. I'm going to have you make your own enso right now. And to do this, Remick and Patrick, could you bring in the bag? There's the bag of pastels and paper. And Patrick, could you bring in a bunch of magazines for people to write on? And while they're bringing that in, I'll explain what we're going to do. You saw Kaz's enso, right? I mentioned that earlier. Well, he introduced this way of making enso that I think is quite delightful. Because many of us are kind of like, what, me draw? This enso you make with pastels. And it works like this. You'll take a piece of paper and you're going to draw a circle on it, or a wonky circle, about twice the size of a Tim Hortons donut. And you go seven times around with one pastel. Then you're going to take another pastel and do another seven. And then you can take a third pastel and do seven more circles and see what it looks like. And this will tell me what your character is.